Patrice Murphy versus the State of Texas, and I'll ask the clerk to call that, please.
And please the court, Mr. Patrick Davis will argue for appellant, Mr. Mark Peterson will argue for the state.
All right. Mr. Davis.
And please, it's on the court.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Justice Holman, Justice Gardner, Justice Walker, thank you for having me. My name is Patrick Davis. I'm a criminal defense attorney here in Tarrant County. This case, in my 13 years of practice, bear with me, this was the most difficult statement of facts that I ever had to go through and put together because the case was seven, eight years old. And I guess even older than that at the time that I went through the briefing process. So I know that there's not ample time in the time that this honorable court has given me to go through all the statements of fact contained in all those clerical records from Cook County. If I miss something, I know that my brief covers it as well, covers everything. If I miss a date, please excuse me. There were a lot of relevant documentations in both files. Briefly, on March 25th, 1998, Patrice Murphy was arrested with Tarita James. She was charged with possession of cocaine over 400 grams and possession of amphetamines over 400 grams. This was a very big drug case, not only for Cook County, but for North Texas at the time. And in fact, I think Mr. Peterson would agree it probably still is today one of the biggest seizures in North Texas. Ms. Murphy obviously is taken into custody. She's charged. She's indicted on May 14, 1998. She bonds out at some point in June, I believe, of that year. On December 21st, 1998, she appears in court with her attorney at that time. I'm not her attorney at that time. She has other trial counsel from San Antonio. She rejects plea offers, and there's a document that I've referred you to where she rejects plea offers and requests a jury trial. On October 27, 1999, Ms. Murphy and Ms. Tarita James have a motion to suppress, a hearing on a motion to suppress, heard by judge, heard by the trial court judge. At that time, and the motion is denied. Going with the facts, and because of the time constrictions, I want to go to the Barker factors immediately and start with the length and the delay and the assertion of the right. I know everything's got to be balanced, so I just want to go with the assertion of right. I think I read Perkins, State v. Perkins, Justice Livingston's opinion. I think there was a motion to quash file in that case, and she said that that was good enough for an assertion of a right. I think you have assertion of a right here to a speedy trial based on the rejection of the plea offer made to her. That piece of paper, please look at it, and then obviously her attorney filing motions, inclusive of a motion to suppress, in which they actually secure a setting and they have a hearing before the trial court judge. We know that...
Don't you have to specifically demand a speedy trial?
No, Judge. No, you do not. There can be a number of overt actions on your part in following Barker v. Wingo that would trigger that. Again, in State v. Perkins, Justice Livingston found a motion to quash to be something of that. I would bring your attention, though, Judge, to the document that I'm talking about. It was a boilerplate document that they have the defendant sign where they actually reject an offer and the thing is set for trial. And that the language in that document I interpreted as absolutely asserting her right to a speedy trial.
And what was the date of that document?
Judge, December 21st, 1998, and I do cite in both briefs, because there are two different files on these cases, and she does sign that document and request a speedy trial on this. She has the hearing before Judge Woodlock. After the hearing, Judge Woodlock on November 1st, 1999, sets the trial for March 6, 2000. Tarita James sat with Ms. Murphy, they consolidated the motion to suppress. They were co-defendants, and they consolidated the motion, so they heard it all together. January 20th, 2000, consolidation is filed pursuant to 3609 by Judge Haverkamp, who happens to be the district attorney at that time. And Judge Haverkamp asked that James' case and Murphy's case be consolidated for trial. Their trial date then is set for sometime in March, I believe, of 2000. On February 18, 2000, Judge Haverkamp, district attorney at that time, files a motion for continuance. And that motion is granted. August 21, 2000 is the new trial date now. On August 9, 2000, the state withdraws its consolidation and says, we just want to try Tarita James. Murphy, you never hear from again. Tarita James is convicted on August 25, 2000 by a Cook County jury. She's sentenced to life in prison. And that's my major argument here today. After that, after Tarita James is sentenced to life, she appeals to this honorable court. Patrice Murphy goes back to Chicago, Illinois. A little bit about Patrice Murphy. 23-year-old at the time. She resides in Chicago, Illinois, and lives with her mother, disabled mother, in Chicago, Illinois. She traveled from Chicago, Illinois, when she was on bond, to Texas repeatedly for court. She never misses court. She always comes to court. After Justice Walker, after that trial, Patrice Murphy is gone in the sense of she never comes back to court because they never asked her to come back to court for nearly 4 years. On June 9, 2004, the DA then requests for a jury trial setting, and Judge Woodlock sets the case for November 1st, 2004. Now, I've asked this honorable court, Justice Gardner, in this particular case, to look at that four-year gap. That's a four-year gap. And we know under Phillips, a silent record, that's not my problem. I don't have to rebut that. The state needed to rebut that, and they never did at the hearing on the dismissal, on the speedy trial dismissal. They never rebut that at all. They never tell us why or what. 4 years is a very long time. It's a presidential term. That's four World Series, that's four Super Bowls, and that's a lot of time to have a lot of jury trials. And I know Cook County is not the biggest county, but that's a lot of time to have a lot of jury trials. We know, obviously, after that point, Judge Haverkamp sets the thing, gets a trial setting. My client starts developing problems, medical problems, swelling in the back of the head. She has a problem called Chiari malformation. I had to look that one up in the medical dictionary. There's a lot of medical records I gave you in the hearing from the motion for new trial. She developed a number of medical problems during this time. She still had trial counsel. She shows up to court on November 1st, 2005. Her attorney prior to that, there were some continuances filed because of the medical condition that my client now had. She had swelling in the back of her head. She had spinal leaking from the surgery, Justice Ullman, that she had had during this time. And again, there's so many facts. I can't hit them all for you, but I'm hitting the big things. You had all this time from 98. We're in the year 2004 now. So at this point, we're 6 years after the fact, nearly. She's developed medical problems. You've got the medical records. They're very voluminous before you, and I did put them in the record for the speedy trial hearing. It'll give you direction, obviously, too, as to what was happening with her. I know we're not doctors, but I tried to explain in layman's terms as well as I could. Getting past that, she enters pleas of guilty on November 1st, 2005 with her trial attorney. Her trial attorney on the same day files a motion to dismiss for speedy trial, but he never secures a ruling, never develops a record, does nothing. She enters pleas of guilty, but here's what's important. She was told by her attorney to get up to that court, to get down from Illinois to Texas. And she was under the care of physicians at Northwestern Memorial Hospital at that time. She was pregnant now. and she still had the spinal leaking, which caused blurry vision, fainting, all kinds of things, which I've noted. But the blurry vision, the fainting, memory loss, things like that. And she was told, and the letter was faxed to Judge Woodlock and the district attorney, that she should not travel at this time. This is a dangerous time for the fetus, and that she would be compromising the fetus if she traveled. Her bond was held and was forfeited, and they ordered the attorneys back on November 1st, 2005, the next day. Well, Patrice and her mom get on a plane, and they get down. And Patrice talks, Miss Murphy talks about her problems on that plane ride, on that plane trip down here to Texas, and the things that she went through. She went against medical advice, obviously, in traveling down to Texas. She enters the pleas of guilty. She's later sentenced in February of 2006. She's allowed to go back home pending a PSI being done, and to have her baby as well. She has her baby, then she comes back, she's sentenced to 20 years. I'm hired later. I had about 4 days, I think, to put this together. I quickly got to the clerk's records and went through it and saw the history that obviously you probably have gone through getting ready for this oral argument. And obviously that I put it together as quick as I could. I filed a motion for new trial and said, hey, this is an involuntary plea. This was ineffective assistance of counsel. And, based on everything that had happened, and Patrice attached her affidavit to it, we had a hearing on that motion, and Judge Woodlock granted it, and we reset the thing for jury trial at that point. I was not hired for purposes of the trial. I'm later hired for purposes of the trial in July. I asked for one continuance, and that continuance was for two things, Justice Holman, to secure a hearing for the dismissal, for the motion for speedy trial dismissal, so we could have a good hearing, a good record for this court if that became important at a later time. And I also asked for it so that I could get ready for trial. This was an 8-year-old, 7-year-old case. I had a lot of things that I had to do. I had to get Dr. Gary Wimbush to test the cocaine and test the amphetamines. I had old witnesses. I had to get my client prepared. I had a number of things to do. Well, what's important in all this, I'm sure this court's wondering that right now, whatever happened to Tarita James? Well, we know that on back on January 9, 2003, this court reversed Tarita James' conviction, reversed it. The state filed a PDR. It was refused by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. And Tarita comes back, and in February, on February 24th of 2005, she strikes a plea bargain with the state. And she gets 20 years, and she agrees that she'll testify against Murphy. Now, Tarita James has just gone through trial. She's gone through the complete appellate process and has gone back to trial and struck a deal. And my client still has not gone to trial. We know that she's developed all kinds of medical problems during this time. And the record is absolutely silent. Now, after that 4-year period, I will concede to this court, we filed continuances. Those continuances were mainly based on the medical condition that Ms. Murphy was going through and based on medical advice that she was following. I think it's foreseeable that anyone during that period of time could develop any type of medical problem. But now we get down to the Barker factors. I went through the assertion of right, Justice Walker, I think I've met that on more than one. You get to the, obviously the judge thought that this was enough time to trigger a speedy trial analysis. So now we get to the reasons for delay. And there's a silent record under Phillips. That's not my problem again. They offered nothing to tell you why or what went on during that time. We know that Judge Haverkamp leaves the DA's office, becomes obviously judge. The Honorable Cindy Stormer takes over. And then we get down to the prejudice. Well, obviously my client's got medical problems, all kinds of medical problems as a result of the what she's gone through. And obviously having the co-defendant, who's now agreed to plead guilty, and agreed to testify against my client, if that's not prejudice, I don't know what is. I believe we've met all those factors. I believe that this thing is an absolute violation of that right. And I believe that that silent record speaks for itself, and that the state never could rebut anything that I've gone over in almost 15 minutes here in trying to implore you to please look at it and reverse Judge Woodlock's decision and enter a judgment of acquittal. This case was not handled properly. Somebody dropped the ball along the way.
I had a question. Was the speedy trial hearing then held before or after she pleaded guilty?
Judge, when she pled guilty with her former counsel, it was carried. It was carried along, and he never secures a ruling, does nothing. And I'm looking through it, and I would.
So you did it at the new trial stage?
Do what, Judge?
You offered all this evidence at the motion for new trial stage?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor. Again, in looking at all the factors, I believe all the factors are in her favor. The Court of Criminal Appeals is very clear that not one factor is determinative. Obviously, you've got to balance all of them, even if I lose on one. But I think I win on all four. And I think that in looking again at this entire case, look at that four-year gap. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Mr. Peterson.
May it please the court. What is the reason why the Sixth Amendment is worded the way it is? And I think it's pretty clear that it is worded in that way to do two things. One, avoid pretrial incarceration, punishing someone who is still presumed innocent. That is not a factor in this case. Patrice Murphy was incarcerated a matter of a day or so prior to her trials, even her second trial. She did go down and begin to serve the sentence that was assessed as a result of her guilty plea. The second reason is to avoid loss of exculpatory evidence. That is not a factor in this case either. There is nothing in this record that shows that Patrice Murphy ever had any exculpatory evidence to present at her trial. That is the reason that there was no denial of a Sixth Amendment right in this case. I want to go briefly through the appellant's brief. And I'm going to start on page 8. The one part that I certainly agree with is interesting in that it cites a 1905 decision of the Supreme Court of the United States. These days, we often just start with Barker versus Wingo. But I think what is said there is just as important. It says the right of a speedy trial is necessarily relative. It is consistent with delays and depends upon circumstances. And then perhaps as important as any other, it says it secures rights to a defendant, but it does not preclude the rights of public justice. And I'm going to suggest that that is the overriding concern in this case. Now, going on page 9, they refer to a reason for delay and cite the Turner case as saying that the burden was somehow on the state of Texas to excuse the delay in this case. Turner is not in point because there were specific demands made for a speedy trial by the defendant in that case. I'm also going to contest the idea that's stated on page 11 that the record gives no explanation for the delays in this case, and I will return to that. As far as the defendant having asserted her right to a speedy trial, I did not realize that State versus Perkins was cited for that proposition, and I guess I'll have to go back and reread it now. If, in fact, it somehow says that the filing of a motion to quash the indictment is an assertion of one's right to speedy trial, then I'm going to wonder exactly why the court would have said that. That doesn't sound like an assertion of a right or a claim or a demand for a speedy trial. Actually, what the appellant says, though, is that she rejected all plea offers by the state, and that somehow gave everyone the idea that, oh, you must be demanding a speedy trial. I don't think that that qualifies either. That occurs in a great many cases, and it simply is not the assertion that is spoken of in Barker. She then further says that, well, I gave further notice to the court I was demanding a speedy trial because I filed a motion to suppress the evidence and asked for a hearing on that motion. Again, I do not think that there's any case that supports that as the argument of giving notice or constituting a demand for a speedy trial. As far as the silence of the record, it is certainly true that a period of almost 4 years passed in this case without any activity by anyone. But I would suggest that it is, of course, ultimately the court has control of when cases are set for trial. Here we have a defendant who's already twice moved for continuances when the case is set at that point.
But I think the four-year delay happened before she moved for a continuance, if I'm reading the briefs correctly.
Well, we need to go back and, I guess, look in some detail of that. The interesting thing is a period of 20 months passed before this case was ever set for trial. And there was never any, as I would say, a request for a speedy trial during that time frame. At that point, it is set for trial. The state moves for a continuance, but it's with the consent or acquiescence of the defendant. There's no hearing, there's no contest, there's no saying, don't grant this because I want a speedy trial. Instead, there is consent by the defendant at that point. The case is then reset, I believe it's in August of 2000, and it simply doesn't get reached for trial at that point. And that is when the four-year time period begins. Then, at the end of that four-year time period, the first time the case is set, what happens? The defendant starts moving for continuances. That's essentially the sequence which we have. And I want to make clear on one point on that, and this is probably a good time to do so. In the state's brief, we essentially say on page 5 that a defendant who requests a continuance thereby temporarily waives her right to a speedy trial, and then I go further to say, and all of the time previously lapsed is no longer considered. That might be considered to be somewhat inconsistent with the holding of the Court of Criminal Appeals in the Zamorano case, where the court notes that a defendant, after a period of time, might move for a continuance due to or arising from unforeseeable events. And then the court said that a lack of readiness at that point would not automatically apply to all prior time periods. The basis for the continuance at the end of that four-year time period was counsel was busy doing other cases. The case had been set in June of 2004 to commence on November 1st of 2004, plenty of notice, and yet shortly before the November 1st date, defense counsel comes forward and says, I'm involved in other trials at this time, continue this case. How much better indication could we have of what the real intent of Patrice Murphy and her counsel were?
But I thought you just said that time doesn't count. I mean, our concern is about the four-year delay when nothing was happening and the fact that she moved for a continuance after that and it actually turned out to be more than 4 years, or that there were explained continuances or resets on the front end of that four-year period. I don't think we're concerned with that. I think we're just concerned with that four-year period of delay.
I think you have to be concerned with the entire time that elapses between indictment and trial. And you have to look at the entire time period to say, have you been denied a speedy trial as of the point where you go to trial? So I understand why the appellant would try to focus on those 4 years, because there's not any reason expressed in the record on what happened during that time. They argue, well, the state dropped the ball for some reason. Well, the state doesn't have control over when a case is set.
But I think the speedy trial case law is that the state, when faced with a speedy trial challenge, has a duty to come forward with some explanation for the delay.
And let me just make clear, there had been no speedy trial challenge in 2000, in 99, or in 98.
But at the motion for new trial hearing, what did the speedy trial challenge was included in the motion for new trial, correct?
Which occurred in 2006. So, again, we're well beyond. I mean, let's look at what was going on in August of 2000 when this case had been set for the second time, was not reached for trial. No one apparently paid any attention to the case after that. Surely, if the trial judge understood the defendant was demanding a speedy trial, he would have set the case for trial during that time period. And I just want to say that even though Tarita James is a co-defendant with the appellant in this case, the proceedings in her case really have nothing to do with the disposition of Murphy's case. Yes, there was a motion to consolidate them at one point. That was abandoned, and they went their own separate ways. So whatever was occurring in the James case doesn't help explain or tell us anything about what's happening in Murphy's case. Let me just go back, and this, the Barker test, I guess, is somewhat difficult to follow because we have close questions that arise all the time, and we have cases that are somewhat difficult to distinguish from each other. But I think what is important that we hear from the cases is that, first of all, none of these factors has a talismanic quality. A court has said that regardless of how you start weighing one factor against another, that, quote, the courts must still engage in difficult and sensitive balancing process. I want to deal with the idea that is there still a requirement, despite the passage of time and despite whether we know exactly what was going on during this four-year time period, is there still a requirement of any showing of actual prejudice? And again, I go back to the idea that's what the Sixth Amendment is designed to protect against. Actual prejudice in the cases talks about oppressive pretrial incarceration, which again is not present in this case. It talks about anxiety and concern, but the cases make clear that that has to be something out of the ordinary or special circumstances that are over and above the type of anxiety and concern that would occur for anybody who's been brought into court on a criminal charge. There is no evidence of that factor in this case either. Ms. Murphy said, well, I was worried about what was going to happen, but I went on with my life in Chicago. She apparently says she never even communicated with her own attorney to find out what was going on during that time period. The third part of actual prejudice is impairment to the defense. And this is always talked in the cases as being the most serious or weighty of the factors under Barker. Again, I want to stress there is no evidence that Patrice Murphy's defense was ever impaired as a result of the passage of time. It is clear the cases say that the Sixth Amendment does not impose a requirement that trial be held within a specified time. They do say that the toleration for the passage of time varies inversely with the delay, but as the Ninth Circuit said in the King case, passage of time alone is not prejudicial. And they probably could have added to the defendant, because it always is prejudicial to the state, and that's an important point. I think what happens is we only have two cases recently from the U.S. Supreme Court to deal with. One is Barker, the other is Doggett versus the United States. We had a very important dissent in the Doggett case, which I urge the court to look at because it helps to explain exactly what the ruling was. But Doggett is somewhat different from what occurs here because we have another whole set of cases where a person is indicted and then they're never arrested. There's a huge period of time that passes before they ever get into court to start out with. And that's the situation in Doggett. It is not the situation in this case. The important part that I want to read from Doggett, they said, and this is the majority opinion, it says, though time can tilt the case against either side, one cannot generally be sure which of them has been prejudiced more severely. I'm going to suggest we can clearly decide that issue in this case. No prejudice to the defense, clear prejudice to the state if there's any prejudice whatsoever. They say we have generally have to recognize that excessive delay presumptively compromises the reliability of the trial. That is not what is at work in this case. A defendant who accepts detriments associated with delay as part of a strategy to avoid conviction or offset the strength of the state's evidence should never be permitted to reap a reward. The importance of a speedy trial is exactly that degree of importance attached to the right by a defendant. at least whereas here it is clear what the strategy or attitude of the defendant was. Her true colors were shown when she repeatedly moved for continuances on bases that would normally not even be granted by the trial court. This is not a case truly involving a silent record, and there is no more blame that lies at the feet of the prosecutor in this case than would lie with the appellant and her own attorneys. We would suggest that there is no showing whatsoever of prejudice, that it is important that the public's interest be protected in this case. That affirmance will not equate with approval of what happened in this case, but it will properly recognize the societal interest in the result of this particular trial and will properly balance what the word speedy meant to this defendant. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Davis.
District attorney, no question about it. When you knew you had to go to Cook County, you better have everything ready, because Judge Haverkamp, she was always ready. Judge Haverkamp would not have filed an Article 3609, Texas Code of Criminal Procedure, Notice of Consolidation. That specific article, Justice Gardner, applies to jury trials. She wasn't getting ready to have a joint plea bargain, a joint, deposition maybe in advance of a plea bargain. She was getting ready for jury trial, because Justice Holman, Judge Haverkamp would not have filed that specific Article 3609 notice to consolidate. She wouldn't have done it, asking and saying, Justice Walker, we want James and we want Murphy. We want them together, and we want them at that table with their counsel, and you all better get ready for trial. We know that on August 9th, 2000, Judge Haverkamp, as DA, withdraws the notice of consolidation, says, we just want James right now. Now, that defeats the entire argument that you just heard from Mr. Peterson, with all due respect. 3609 is specific, and it talks about jury trials. It doesn't talk about anything else. I'll go back to the prejudice. My client testified that she suffered from migraines, blurry vision, swelling of the brain, fainting, passing out. The medical records back it all up. This woman was under care at Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago, Illinois, as a result of the malformation in the back of her cerebellum that she suffered from and had surgery for. We know that this court has said as well in Burgett v. State, 865 Southwest 2nd, 594, Fort Worth, 1998, petition refused. Actual proof of prejudice is not required, only some showing that the delay was prejudicial. And of course, we all know Zamorano, the Court of Criminal Appeals case, where they state, the majority, even if appellant's actual prejudice was minimal, condoning prolonged and unjustifiable delays in prosecution would both penalize many defendants for the state's fault and simply encourage the government to gamble with the interests of criminal suspects assigned a low prosecutorial priority. I have no idea why or what happened during that four-year period. I don't know why Patrice Murphy was lost in the system, but I know that when we filed our briefs in this case, this honorable court set this thing for oral argument, and we weren't lost in the system. Trita James was never lost in the system. For some reason, she was lost in the system in Cook County. And yes, society has an interest, and that interest also applies to defendants. I have a very important footnote, briefly, Justice Holman, on page 13 of my brief. It's important to the criminal defense bar, and I'd ask this court to please address it. It's a sub-point. It talks about Rule 104D. My worry is what the state was allowed to do over my objection. When my client was testifying, the state was allowed over my 104D objection to inquire as to whether appellant had made a statement incriminating herself at the time of her arrest. I objected. I cited the Mendoza case out of the 10th Court of Appeals in Waco. And my worry would be that 104D is really important to us. Justice Walker, when we have suppression hearings, I'm not really talking about speedy trial right now, but yes, speedy trial as well, but really suppression hearings. And sometimes we have to put our clients on the stand. We don't want them to be able to ask our client if they committed the offense, because then that just destroys our entire defense if we want to take the thing to trial. And I put that in a sub-point, Justice Holman. I would ask this court, Justice Gardner, if you could please address it, because I think it's important to the defense bar. If we don't have that, boy, we're really taking a step back. And I think the legislature was clear when they had Rule 104D, stick with what's going on here. I don't have a problem with dimming memories. Dimming memories is one thing. Asking her if she's come to court with her mother all that time, but asking her if she committed the offense, that's a clear violation of Rule 104D of the Texas Rules of Evidence, and I'd ask that you please protect that. The criminal defense bar asks that you please protect that. I thank you for your time. I would ask this court to please reverse the decision of Judge Woodlock, the trial court. Judge Woodlock had a lot to deal with here. This was a tough one, that you reverse this and that you enter a judgment of acquittal for Ms. Murphy. Again, there's no explanation for the 4 years that this court has concentrated on and that I've concentrated on. And Ms. Murphy's testimony is pretty clear in the record, what she went through and what all that time was like. And I can just say that the record before you, including Tarita James, is important. And I spent almost 5 hours here in Stephanie Robinson's office in your court, preparing for that hearing and gathering those records and going through so that you would have a complete record. Justice Holman, Justice Gardner, Justice Walker, thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Davis, Mr. Peterson. The arguments have been very helpful to us, and you are dismissed, and we'll hear from us shortly.